This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 54, and I'm delighted to welcome a grand fromage of the London fintech scene to discuss where fintech is going. Giles Andrews has been leading what is in essence the UK's longest running fintech per se. He was part of the team that created Zopa in 2004, became CEO in 2007, and became executive chairman in 2015. As we will hear in the next episode following this, with one of the UK's leading economists, the question of the future of FS is a good one. Or rather, it's one which he, name shall come clear later, the former governor of the Bank of England and the former head of the FSA are all agreed. There will be another crisis in FS, as all the changes that have been made to banking so far will not prevent it. As well as the fundamental weaknesses in the structure of FS, we will discuss in the next episode what various opportunities that the problems in FS creates for fintech per se to be a fundamental force for good in reforming FS, even in part into a system which serves the people and business rather than itself. That's the large strategic context. At the more tactical level, I've been wondering for some time whether perhaps what we should call FinTech 1.0 is losing steam. Or rather, there are lots of solid, touches wood, businesses like Zopa out there, which are pretty mature by now and pretty stable in what they do. There's a further challenge, as we heard from John Volmeo in LFP 052, of a Hong Kong VC who scanned 1,000 fintechs globally and estimated that less than 5% are making a profit. And before we get all dot-com about this, the vast majority of businesses do thrive better making profits than losses. Indeed, insider gossip in London has one or two well-known cash burners in need of another VC to pour another bucket load of money in or sell themselves on. For sure, there's an argument that the revolution needs rebooting. We need a fintech 2.0 in some cases. One obvious example of this is that all the hypesters have moved on from Bitcoin, fintech 1.0, to blockchain, fintech 2.0 perhaps. Another is in payments. The likes of GoCardless in LFP 046 provide a great service, but have had to run on the rails of existing banks, as do many so-called fintech banking providers right now. Which rather leads on to matters such as PSD2 and the whole curveball of the UK voting to leave the EU. So there's lots out there, and who's better to discuss these things than Giles? There's plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Morning, Giles. Thank you for joining me today.
Morning, Mike.
So, as I said up front, you've had quite a long career, perhaps the longest career of anybody in fintech, being well over a decade now on a phenomenon that most people have only heard of in the last 1, 2, 3 years, depending where you're coming from. So how have the various roles worked out for you? Say you were changing your role again last year. Or you're doing the same thing all along and they give you different badges every now and then?
I think there are some changes along the way. Use of the word fintechs I always find interesting. So we used to describe ourselves as a technology-enabled financial services business, and that was a bit of a mouthful. And someone came up with fintech, which was rather shorter and pithier. It's been interesting to observe the hype that built around fintech that probably began to dissipate somewhat throughout the course of last year and this year. In terms of my own personal role, I joined the founding team of Zopa to help raise some money. I think if you'd talk to anyone in that team, I was probably the one who was least connected with the business and sort of viewed it as a project. But I happened to really like the team, happened to really like the people, and thought the idea was fantastic and was originally persuaded to stay and became the company's CFO, ironically. I say ironically because I'm not an accountant, but I'd operated payroll and things like that in other small businesses.
But you had an overdraft as a student, so you knew about losses.
Yeah. And as a sort of the chief fundraiser in the business, I suppose, that was tangentially related to the business's finances. Maybe CFO was a reasonable role. Without sort of boring your listeners with the story of Zopa, we had some pretty big events to deal with, not least the death in 2006 of the company's first CEO, a guy called Richard Duval, who was a really inspirational leader and was certainly a big part of my reason to choose to stay at Zopa. And it's a sort, you know, it's not exactly the way anyone wants to inherit managing a business because someone dies. But in 2007, 2008, I think it became apparent that I was probably the best placed person within the founding team to run it because, actually, ironically, of my small business background and the fact that Zopa was a pretty small business and rather smaller in 2007, 2008 than any of us had thought it would be when we founded it. And I think that speaks to the story of consumer fintech businesses, that actually one of the biggest challenges is to achieve any sort of scale, and meaningful customer adoption generally takes longer and costs more money than anyone ever predicts it will.
It takes a long time for people to trust you. I mean, I think it was a year or two ago, I was on a tube and I saw an advert for some fintech that was going to do holiday cash. And I thought, oh, well, that's much better than being ripped off in the usual thing. And despite the fact I'm immersed in the fintech, I hadn't heard of this company whatsoever. And I thought, well, would I really trust them? Would I send money to some company I've never heard of whatsoever? You know, and I haven't heard them since. But so it's probably a good job I didn't. But, you know, let's say they had persisted. As you say, it would take a long time before even the likes of me would actually trust them, let alone my mum or my dad.
And that generally means that actually spending significant amounts of money on marketing before you've built that trust is actually wasted money. And I think it took a major sort of world dislocation in the credit crisis to make people visit the value we offered and view it perhaps more favourably than they had before. And we only really started achieving scale in the years following the crisis.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the other phenomenon, which we've all spoken about quite a lot, sometimes implicit, which is that it took 2008 for people, by and large, to start hating banks and therefore be very open to something which isn't a bank doing financial services. You know, I think if you go back sort of 15 years, well, Barclays was Barclays and Lloyds was Lloyds, and, you know, why did you need to change it? I haven't been through many banks personally in terms of my current account, and I doubt that you have since we were students. And it wasn't really on the top sort of 1,000 things that was doing our head in compared to other stuff.
No, so I think the consumers lost an awful lot of trust in banks around the events of the crisis, and, you know, conduct. Lots of things happened at similar sort of times. So, you know, the banning of PPI and the huge scandal that unfolded after that.
And PPI, for people who haven't heard of it?
Payment Protection Insurance. So the biggest mis-selling scandal in UK financial services history so far cost £35 billion in compensation.
Which is, for those people abroad, which the majority of listeners these days, is that in the past, when you were getting a mortgage out, just in case you lost your job or something, you would take out this PPI, which was subsequently decided to be a mis-selling, which I'm sure it was, and then the scope of that grew and grew into the figure that you say now.
Yeah, it was a product that probably had some purpose to a small number of consumers, and had it been charged sensibly, not with sort of 80% gross margins, then it wouldn't have been the mis-selling scandal it turned into. The enormous profitability of the product led to very bad behaviour and, you know, incentives to mis-sell. So the loss of trust in banking because of events of the crisis, because of the conduct issues, particularly in the UK, coincided with a period where bank economics changed. And I'm a passionate believer that for fintech businesses to be interesting, they need to offer either better value to consumers or better service experience, or ideally both. And we were able to offer the former much more easily when bank economics changed fundamentally as a result of the crisis. So suddenly the value offering we had, the improvement in value we could offer consumers became much, much easier to deliver. Whereas prior to that, arguably, we'd simply offered the better experience, which I don't think is enough to build an interesting and sustainable business. And I think you're still seeing some of that. I mean, I think some of the fintech champions actually are more about better customer experience and not necessarily all about value. And the ones that go on to win, I think, will focus on the value as much as the experience.
Yes, it's a whole interesting question on the profitability. We'll kick the can down the road on that one for the moment, but it is quite an important one. I mean, we've all heard the tech story that you need to grow in scale, and as you say, you need to establish trust and infrastructure and da-di-da-di-da-di. But it's quite hard, let's say 10, 20, 30 years into a business, to be still losing money after decades, because the VCs eventually, well, actually, they all retire and a new bunch come in.
It's not complicated. You need very strong marginal economics. Yes. If you've got strong marginal economics, at least you can tell a story that with scale you will achieve sustainable profitability. I think people are having to think again as to what that scale will be, needs to be, in the sense that I think most fintech businesses are probably concentrating more on reaching profitability quicker than they would have been, say, 3 years ago. But at least they have to have those strong marginal economics. And I sort of despair when I see presentations or decks where even on a marginal basis people aren't reporting profitability.
Yes, and for those people running fintechs, that's a very good tip about how to phrase it all to your VCs. But I mean, I've seen the similar thing myself, and I've got one or two in mind, and I'm not going to gossip, but where in essence they seem to be losing more money the more customers they acquire, which is the opposite.
Yes, never a good sign.
Never a good sign, no, because actually you get infinite growth, but then you've also got infinite losses. So then last year, Giles, you moved up from CEO to become executive chairman, and having been around a little bit and lost most of my hair, phrases like executive chairman mean different things in different places.
Yeah, I don't think there are very set definitions. Although having said that, JDev and I did actually spend a bit of time researching.
JDev is the CEO.
JDev is the CEO, has been now for close to a year. So JDev joined the company nearly 2 years ago as COO, having had a similar role to COO here at Capital One in the UK, where he was the CMO. But Capital One has an interesting structure where the CMO doesn't just look after marketing, but also looks after credit risk. And if you think about it, they're sort of two of the biggest operational functions within our business are marketing and management of credit risk. So that set him up very well to be our COO. And we did that without a formal succession plan in mind. I suppose at some point I knew that I wouldn't be the CEO of the company forever. But as we began to work together, it became increasingly apparent that JDev managed the internal functions of the business.
Yeah.
And he did so extraordinarily well. And in fact, you know, his first full year, 2015, was probably the company's best year for 6 or 7 years. No small part down to the impact he made. And I was increasingly focused on looking at the external side of the business.
So in essence, he stays in the office and you go out of the office, roughly speaking?
Not quite as simple as that. And I do drag him out from time to time as well.
And he does drag you back sometimes?
And he drags me back into the office. But broadly speaking, that's how we split the role. And I sort of describe the executive chairman bit of my role. I think I have sort of two jobs. One is a very part-time and occasional job, which is called chairing a board meeting, which happens, well, you know, once a month or occasionally a little bit more. And that was something I was keen to take on. Actually, I'd never done that before. We all like to grow and learn new things, and I was quite keen to manage that board.
What I know from chairman of various FS companies of all sorts of scale, some of them quite large, is that being a chairman is a little bit sort of like being in war where not much is going on. So for a large period of time, it's actually relatively routine and relatively dull, and you're going through the agenda, and you know, sometimes you're herding cats and all this kind of stuff. And every now and then, all hell breaks loose, and the job goes through an utterly digital change into something completely different for a period of time, and the sort of fire going around your head. So hopefully, the latter phase won't happen for some time.
Indeed, I would agree with that. And then the executive part of my role is that I am an executive in the business. So executive chairman does not mean the boss of the CEO, for example. It means someone who chairs board meetings and has an, the executive part means they have an executive role within the business, in the fulfillment of which I very clearly work for JDev. So there are relationships that I manage on the company's behalf.
Exactly. So sometimes you're on top and sometimes he's on top, as it were, metaphorically speaking, of course. So moving on then, so in the terms of the overall context, as we're saying, that the 2008 is a critical thing, without which fintech probably would have existed, but in no other different shape. So now we have this whole UK leaving the EU thing. For those people listening who are outside UK, they won't have anywhere near, I assume, your and my degree of boredom with the whole subject. It's been absolutely thrashed to death non-stop throughout the media for weeks and months and months, and, well, putting it in the super big picture, for decades and decades. So very briefly, off the top of my head, the history of it is that the UK was quite keen on joining the common market as it then was, but a couple of times in the 1960s, General de Gaulle of France vetoed our entry. In something like 73, Edward Heath, then Prime Minister, gave the country a vote and we voted in. I've quite forgotten why, but then in 1975, under the Labour Harold Wilson, there was another referendum on whether we should stay in, and we stayed in, and then the whole Thatcher years about renegotiating our position, da-da-da-da-da. And then there was the whole kind of evolution, to be polite, of the EU from what the UK joined in the 70s, which was a common market, through whole things like the European Monetary System, which we were part of, the Euro, which we weren't part of, and increasingly a kind of political project. And so actually one of the things that's always surprised me is people are saying that actually we reversed the decision of 1973. At one level we have, but the sort of the club we joined is rather different to the club we left. And I think that, you know, in terms of the overall picture, one of the challenges, and again just to keep it simple for people abroad, but also actually for a number of people in the UK who don't really seem to have emphasised this so much, although it's becoming clear, and we're recording this just a few days after the vote, which is that it was a vote to leave something. The population decided they were against this. But it wasn't a vote for something. So there are many possibilities of the future. It wasn't, do you think the UK should leave the EU and be in EFTA? Or do you think it should leave the EU and be in the Council of Europe? Or do you think we should remain in the single market? Which is probably a great help to the Leave campaign, because there's a huge range of disagreements. Boris Johnson, I thought, did a very good speech after the event. And he's clearly an extremely European person who actually quite likes Europe and wants to stay as close to it as he can whilst being out of the EU. At the opposite extreme, some of the more sort of nationalistic people would actually quite like to sort of build a wall, as well as having sort of water all around the country and What all this means is going to become clear slowly over years and years and years. And I've seen initial reactions from people in business and people in FS and people in fintech and people in P2P. And it's, you know, kind of reflecting on the one hand, the sort of the emotion of the whole thing. It was an extremely divisive campaign on both sides. A select committee, cross-party select committee of MPs censured both sides for basically lying through their teeth. So it wasn't really a good vote for how well the UK can do a democracy. But what the future holds as a whole economically really depends on where we are in 5 years' time. And of course, fintech is a subset to that. So what have you made of the whole thing then, Giles?
Well, I'm still feeling pretty raw, actually. We're speaking on the Monday following the vote, so, you know, only a weekend has passed. So I'm disappointed in the sense that I was keen that the UK continues to play an important part in shaping the European project, or as much of a role as it could. And, you know, I don't buy into all the negativity around how awful Europe has been. If you think back when we joined the EU in 1973, UK economically was a basket case. And in spite of this awful meddling that we've had to put up with from Brussels ever since, the EU economy has been transformed and was, at least until Friday, the fifth biggest economy in the world. Now, I understand, the sixth, as a result of sterling's devaluation. Let's hope that's not a sort of a sign of what will come. I share with you the sort of boredom of the campaign, but I don't share with you boredom of thinking about the issue. I worry about a couple of things. So I worry that uncertainty is bad for economies, and the very fact that we don't know where we are, wearing a terribly optimistic entrepreneur's hat, I could say that's a good thing. The uncertainty means that, you know, out of that, opportunity can be created. But actually, more rationally, uncertainty is a bad thing. It's a bad thing for business investment, it's a bad thing for hiring, and the fact that we don't know where we are, and in reality probably won't for at least a year, if not several, I think puts us in a challenging position, which worries me. So I think, you know, there is a reasonable risk stroke possibility of recession. And anyone running a business, that's not a great thing. And in financial services, recessions tend not to be great things either, because in recessions, people lose their jobs, or, you know, economic conditions dictate that people have difficulty servicing debt. So I'm not trying to be a prophet of doom, but you'd have to say that the possibility of poor credit performance has gone up as a result of what happened last week.
Yes.
Which we in the lending business need to be incredibly mindful of, and are. We clearly had thought it through in advance and had contingency plans, and it's a very hot topic in terms of our, you know, our risk management. But we have to be alert to the risks.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, going back to 2008, it's a bit like sailing a boat. You know, you were sailing your small zipper boat, and then this huge storm of 2008 came along, which must have caused you a whole number of challenges and headaches.
And created opportunity.
At the same time, creates opportunity, that, you know, and you get through the storm, and actually it turns out that you, not only did you get through the storm in better shape, but actually it sort of spawned a whole new thing. And in the same way at the moment, going back to the uncertainty, as you say, on the, you know, the rosy scenario is that we could get through the storm in 5 years' time and go, wow, and then fintech really took off or something, or, you know, it could be a disaster.
I have every confidence that our credit performance...
I meant for the UK, not for...
I have every confidence in our own individual credit performance, and I think, therefore, in that sense, you know, recession could turn out in the long run to be a good thing for us. But, you know, we've got to think a little bit less parochially than
yes.
that, and think about the economy as a whole, and think about consumers
absolutely.
As a whole.
Absolutely. Coming back to the big picture, though, in terms of what you say and your disappointment and all that kind of thing, the whole debate was conducted in these extreme tones, and actually I don't recall hearing anybody say, in terms of remaining in the EU, these are the six main advantages that I see. In terms of remaining in the EU, these are the six main disadvantages I see. And to put numbers around that, I mean, my partner's in the civil service, so she's starting to see this already. From what I read, there are 50,000 agreements there were in, 50,000 documents the civil service has got to go through and start unwinding. So, of course, any sensible, rational adult who is not thinking emotionally could imagine a spreadsheet with 50,000 lines, and again, just being oversimplistic, of course, a tick or a cross in terms of which ones are good and which ones are bad.
Not a terribly useful use of the time of some of the brightest and best minds we have in the country to be doing that kind of work.
I think when there's huge constitutional change that takes place, there is a huge cost of doing so. At the same time, I remember from school, going back to the longer history of the UK, I remember from school in history, which I wasn't particularly interested in, but the history of the sort of several centuries before the 20th, none of which particularly concerned me then or now, was that the phrase still sticks with me now from about the age of 15, which was that the UK, or Britain, has always had one foot on the continent and one foot on its island. And that's very well represented still now by a roughly 50-50 split about, you know, the one people whose main foot is on the UK and main foot abroad. And going back to the uncertainty, that really comes from the structure of the referendum. If the referendum had been, and I say this wouldn't be an advantage of the Leave campaign at all, if the referendum had been, do you think we should leave the EU and join the European Free Trade Association and be like Norway, Iceland and Switzerland, that would have been a clear picture and there would have been no uncertainty. And then coming back to the overall thing about the whole scare campaign and that kind of thing, I just saw today that George Osborne, who had insisted a week or two ago that if we leave we will be punished with higher taxes and reduced pensions and this emergency budget, has now admitted that that emergency budget never existed. So the whole fear around hasn't really helped. And I think that, you know, there needs to be some time to calm down. It is like a divorce. There are many, many parties and factions within Europe have got different perspectives. The Eurocrats right at the top are very keen to sort of see that the UK is punished in a very similar way to that I think the Greek was punished over the euro. On the other extreme, you've perhaps got the Germans who are very keen that trade continues in a good sense. And one of the statistics I saw was that for every £6 that Europe buys of UK goods, we buy £10 of European goods. So there's a, you know, a whole number of dynamics over there in terms of wanting, on the one hand, to continue with a good relationship after the divorce, for the sake of the kids, as it were, but on the other hand, not wanting to encourage other more peripheral people who are actually sort of, you know, weaker holds for Europe to start leaving and the whole thing fall apart. So I think you're right that there's a huge period of uncertainty, but I do think that for the new fintechs coming along, that should create opportunity. We are where we are. The Independent put it really well for people like you, Giles, who really wanted... I mean, I didn't mind which happened. I'm very happy to go along with democracy. People go in, people go out. That's what it is. But the Independent said for people like us in the Independent who wanted to remain, we should have 3 days of mourning and then we wake up on Monday and we make the best of the world we live in.
Unquestionably. And let's hope that the way the negotiations are conducted is critical. And let's hope that that's done in the most responsible way it can. And I have every faith that it will be. So I agree with you. We've got to get on with life. I mean, I think there are some practical difficulties for some businesses in the world of fintech. So, and this doesn't actually relate nearly as much to us as to many others. In the sense that we're a very UK-focused business. So we have investors who live in the UK and we lend money to people who live in the UK. So we're not immune to localised credit shocks, but we're not trying to do cross-border business the whole time. I think some fintech businesses, in order to reach interesting scale, probably need to be operating across Europe.
And some of them, like Funding Circle, already are.
And therefore, any challenge to that is not particularly helpful.
Yes, and I saw that, and I was rather shocked by this one. I mean, going back to the different perspectives on this, the European Central Bank, which I thought was supposed to be apolitical, but then again, I follow Yanis Varoufakis very closely, and I don't think he'd think the European Central Bank is apolitical. I saw them say over the weekend that unless the UK remains in the single market and has open borders, then its financial services companies can't sell into Europe. And I didn't quite manage to connect in my own mind cross-selling of financial services between various countries with open borders.
I think the rights to EU passporting will be up for debate.
Exactly, exactly. It's a negotiation position.
So I'm sure it will remain open for people in the UK to seek authorization in other countries. I don't think anyone's going to stop people doing business, but just the ease, the passporting regime has been helpful for UK businesses to operate in Europe and indeed the other way around. So, you know, there are many French and German businesses in the UK that use passporting that are as worried about potentially losing that right.
So coming on to then this whole sort of FinTech 2.0 question, whether the revolution needs rebooting in a way, and I say the clearest example is, I think, is Bitcoin, where people have given up banging the drum by and large, but there's a hell of a lot of drum banging going on with blockchain, which seems to have inherited a few of, surprise, surprise, a few of Bitcoin's problems, one of which is awful terminology. I went to a seminar last week with Fox Williams. John Siegel, who's been on the show before, said rather nicely, well, let's be clear about smart contracts. They're neither smart nor are they contracts. So they've carried on in that particular silo of fintech with awful terminology. In terms of, let's take the P2P because that's very close to home, you've got a whole bunch of firms, whether they're 5 years old or 10 years old, who are now the new incumbents. So any change in the environment, the threat is perceived more rapidly than the opportunities. And I'm also including things like lending clubs, problems in the States, an 80% share price fall and all that kind of thing. So is FinTech 1.0, you know, are you guys in a sense, the new incumbents, and there needs to be some sort of new younger kids on the block coming and being sort of young thrusters and taking advantage of where you are slightly slower-footed compared to them, even though you're incredibly nimble compared to the mega banks like Citigroup and all that kind of stuff.
I think any industry is liable to give the horrible word of disruption, but any players can be disrupted if people come along and offer better value or better service to consumers. And we are and should be vulnerable to that if indeed someone comes up with a better way. So I'm not sure I really get the distinction between, I mean, in a sense, fintech in itself, I think, is a somewhat dangerous term because it encompasses such a massively wide range of activities. And therefore, I think, you know, to differentiate between fintech one and fintech two isn't necessarily helpful. But I repeat what I said before, that I think there's an increasing onus on fintech businesses to show and demonstrate their ability to sustain themselves. Investment is harder to gain than it was a year ago, and that's because of events in the public markets that have happened that you mentioned, and just a growing realization that these businesses need to be self-sustaining. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think it's a great thing, and I think it will mean that there will be a sorting of some wheat from some chaff. And in that process, you may find a mixture of Darwinian evolution of the existing businesses, and you may see opportunities for new other players to come along. I wouldn't want to predict the future.
Would you like to predict the past?
All I care about is that we continue along that path as positively as we are now.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is that, as you say, all these words are a bit sort of silly, but they're just all provisional labels. One of the things is that fintech set its stall out as the opposite of these vast conglomerates. So something like Cedars does equity crowdfunding, Zupa does, and you've pretty much stuck to your knitting better than some others. You do consumer lending peer-to-peer. So one of the things almost that fintech is saying is that actually we're going to be small, focused, digitally enhanced financial services companies, and we stick to that. So it's at this stage a little tricky to imagine a first generation, if you want to call it that, first generation fintech starting to diversify, and maybe you have some secret plans in a year's time to have an equity crowdfunding division that takes on Cedars, and maybe you've got some secret plans to have a payments division that takes on Glo Cardless, but it's almost against the philosophy of fintech to start doing that kind of
thing. I think you're right. I think one of the ways that the more successful fintech businesses, one of the things they benefit from is, I think, a real focus and real specialization, sticking to their knitting. And it's easier to provide the value and the service to consumers I talk about endlessly if you have a very specialized offering. And I think that will continue. I don't think you'll see conglomeration, if that's the right word, of different fintechs.
I don't think we'll see it directly, but of course, I can imagine, and I'm sure you've imagined it many times, you know, in 5 to 10 years' time, the likes of Zopa, Funding Circle and Rates had all been swallowed by some mega bank for some, you know, huge price, and press releases coming out saying this is the way forwards and, you know, da-di-da-di-da-di.
A lot of businesses define themselves in their early days as to what they're not.
Yes.
So you're right. So we define ourselves as not a bank and in competition with banks. I think over time, what we do is we build capability. Let's look at what Zopa's good at. Zopa's very good at originating loans cost effectively. It's very good at servicing those loans, and it's very good at underwriting credit risk. And out of that, we generate value for consumers. Now, those services are interesting in and of themselves.
Absolutely.
So this sort of focus on not being something can evolve over time to one of, well, what are we therefore good at? You know, when we started the business, we didn't necessarily have quite such a clear view about what we would be good at as we have now got a view on what we are good at. And some of those services are interesting to people within the ecosystem. Some of those services are interesting to our competitors.
Absolutely. And wearing your chairman's hat, you'll be acutely aware that the function of a board chaired by the chairman is to create value for the shareholders as well as the...
all the stakeholders of the business.
All the stakeholders of the business. And if you're creating value for the shareholders and if you're doing something well, as you say, then by definition, firms like that become attractive to the stock market, to people wanting to put equity money in themselves, to people listening who might, you know, 2 or 3 years' time or whenever it is, put money into Zopa because you're listed on the stock exchange. And equally, at that point, you become an attractive acquisition target for other businesses, by definition.
Yes, but you also become an attractive partner. So, I mean, you know, we partner with banks. So Metro Bank lends its depositor funds, effectively, money it's got from retail consumers on deposit. It lends some of those funds on Zopa because it recognises that we're good at the things I said we were good at. And therefore, your capabilities open the door to partnership. And that's really interesting.
No, absolutely.
That's much less about what you're not and much less about being competitive with incumbents and much more around how do we work with the ecosystem as a whole, including potentially our competitors, to generate value for customers.
Yes, this is probably a completely wrong metaphor, but never mind. Sort of little boys and little girls will generally define themselves little, being quite small ones, four or five, by not being the opposite. Little boys do not want to be little girls and vice versa, by and large, although there's some sort of tomboys and all that kind of stuff. So perhaps you've got into the stage where you're not defining yourself as not being a little boy or a little girl, but you're now in your teenage years and you're starting sort of dating with them. And eventually, and we're speaking as men here, you get acquired. And the relationship changes there. So coming back to this fintech theme then, I think, you know, that's quite a useful discussion, which is the evolution of a fintech. I mean, John Vollmer, I mentioned earlier, he was on talking about the challenges of being a scale-up, and they've got an investment by Deutsche Börse, and you become a more mature company, and you know, you see things differently from a startup, and it presents its own challenges. One of the ideas I'd had about FinTech 2.0 was that FinTech 1.0 ran on the banking rails, as I mentioned, and FinTech 2.0, Rich Wagner on the Emerging Payments Association was here, and he's got his own FinTech, which started actually long before Zapa, but wasn't called a FinTech then. In the payment space, a good example is allowing FinTechs to have direct access to the payment systems or direct accounts with the Bank of England, rather than having to sit on top of banking relationships and go through them. Because in a sense, and I don't mean this derogatory at all because it's a very hard job, but in a sense, if you have to sit on top of banks forevermore, in the payment space certainly, then all you're actually doing is putting a nicer, friendlier front end onto existing processes. The likes of the peer-to-peer sidestepped all that and just directly, the peer-to-peer, of course, took money from one person and gave it to another without having to intermediate the bank on the credit side, although, of course, you still use the banking payments processes.
There's a very interesting speech which I would commend to your listeners, which wasn't given, but it's available. You can download it on the web.
The best speech never given on fintech.
But Mark Carney was due to give a speech at the Mansion House, which was focusing on fintech, interestingly. And he didn't give the speech because of the terrible shooting of Joe Cox, which meant that the speech was never given. But it, certainly you can download it. And it says some really significant things. And one of the things it talks about is how the Bank of England is going to work with non-bank payment service providers and effectively offer them access, well, offer to underwrite and provide capital in support of their activities. And I think that's sort of what you're describing, that non-banks are beginning to get more fundamental access on a more level playing field basis to various banking services, which, if it continues and happens, I think will create much greater competition and potentially very interesting opportunities for consumers. Now, back to the dreaded Brexit debate, I would worry about some of the implementation of PSD2, some of which plays into this and again provides greater access to, none of which is directly relevant to Zopa, but obviously I watch the space. I'm interested in the space outside of Zopa. And frankly, you know, is there a risk that that might not get implemented in the same way because it was being driven by initiatives out of Brussels? It's beyond my pay grade, I'm afraid, to have too strong an opinion on it. But I would be fearful of some collateral damage to that initiative because one would imagine, I don't think it's too cynical to say the banks probably would prefer it didn't happen, and therefore does this potentially give a lobbying opportunity to kick it into the long grass?
Absolutely, and you know, I think there's a much bigger picture question under there which definitely can go either way, which is that in terms of financial services regulation, we've been increasingly driven as part of the European bloc to have the same regulation, for example, on derivatives, EMIR and MIFID and a whole bunch of stuff like that, and there has been a process for creating it, but we're going to have to go back to the future where we make up our own financial services regulation, perhaps in banking or insurance or in Europe. There's no particular reason, let's say 5 years from now, there's no particular reason why the UK, for example, has to have, say, European legislation on banking. It could have its own. It could adopt America's. It could do something completely different. And that's absolutely all out there. And going back to sort of civil servants, I mean, you know, their job at the moment is to sit down and work out the million things they've got to think through. And going back to the Bank of England, and you mentioned Mark Carney, the governor, the Bank of England's going to have to go, oh, blimey. So that's going back to where we were about 20 years ago when we made up banking regulation for the UK on our own basis.
Or it may make greater sense for us to follow the European regulations still.
Yes.
Because it provides us greater access to a market. Who knows?
Exactly. Although in financial services, there's perhaps been more whinging about European financial services regulation than anything else. And so it does remains to be seen what's going to happen about that. One of the things, again, I mean, if people think this may be getting a bit sort of big picture and political, well, it's intended to be big picture in the first place. And I think we're just showing the extent to which everything operates in a context. And the context we have around the world is that there's less and less democracy, I feel, and there's more and more corporatism. So when the government is doing new tax laws, the likes of KPMG and those men are advising the Treasury on it in great detail, and when it's doing financial services regulation, the corporates and the big banks are in there. And it remains to be seen whether we become more corporatized, shall we say, the banks get more direct lobbying of the Bank of England and more direct lobbying of the politicians and more direct lobbying of the Treasury, and therefore the new regulations in the next 5 or 10 years in financial services become more pro-big bank. An example of the EU is where they've stood up to Google and the likes of Apple and all this kind of stuff. They've provided a bigger barrier, perhaps. So we could become more corporate with less opportunities to fintech, or we could go down the opposite extreme and do what the UK has always been good at for centuries, which is the kind of thought leadership and coming up with new ideas. It really is to be seen. But I think the positive thing for that, which is that new people listening can keep their eyes open and spot the opportunities and go and do them. So, following through with this theme of corporate and institutional political power, there's also corporate and institutional money. And one of the things that's changed a lot since 2005 is the flow of institutional funds into peer-to-peer lending. These have dropped off recently and perhaps caused more problems in the States than they have over here. And how do you see this, Giles, in terms of the balance between private individuals putting money into platforms in general, and specifically Zopa, and institutional funds?
So I'm a bit old-fashioned in the sense that I maintain my view that I had when we launched the business, that it was an interesting retail business. That the problem we were trying to solve was inability for ordinary consumers like you and I, not wealthy people who have access to all sorts of esoteric products, but ordinary people had a dearth of opportunity to make reasonable risk-adjusted returns with their spare cash. And I still maintain that that's the biggest opportunity, if you like, for our business, is to continue to serve retail consumers. So we're still majority, more than half the funding on Zopa is provided by retail customers. I also became quite alarmed as I saw the incredible growth of institutional lending in the US, and in particular the kind of people who were doing it. So hedge funds piling in to an asset class that they saw providing them with an opportunity, and most people know that money that comes in very fast can disappear very fast as well. So as we began to think about how do we help secure faster growth on the borrowing side of our business by bringing in some institutional capital, we were very concerned about what that institutional capital looked like. And therefore it took us rather a long time to find the right institutional partners. So we didn't have institutional lending at any scale on Zopa till about 2014. And I think it took the maturity of our business and the sort of track record we had in delivering great risk-adjusted returns to people, it took that time to find people who we considered to be great long-term partners of the business rather than quick to bring in and quick to see the back of. And I think, you've seen that story play out faster than I would have ever thought, but it is a story that I thought I would see play out at some point, which is, the falling out of love, if you like, of some of these slightly flightier sources of capital with our asset class. In terms of our own performance, we haven't lost any institutional money, and the partners we have are great long-term partners who will help us grow our business in a slightly more predictable way than if we were having to rely exclusively on retail funds. But we're certainly very keen, and in fact you may have seen, we launched some new retail lending products this year, which have been very successful and have brought in, significant growth from our retail base. So that shows, if you like, the focus we have on our retail customers and will continue to have.
Yes, I mean, it's probably the wrong note to strike, but I've seen the various products and not spent enough time sort of going into them. And I'm getting a bit confused now about like Coke and Coke Classic and all this kind of thing. So just very briefly, if you want to leave people with a rather clearer idea of, if they're going to put money into Zopa, they can get A, B or C these days.
Yeah, so with our new products, we were trying to do two things. First of all, we had a number of people saying, you've demonstrated over a number of years that you are very good at managing credit and risk, and that's great, but actually we'd like something that's potentially a little bit more exciting, potentially offering a slightly higher risk but higher return product, and launched our Safeguard product in 2012.
Which is the provision fund.
Which is a way to protect investors from a sort of first loss scenario. But a number of our customers who'd been with us for 5, 6, 7 years before, without the benefit of Safeguard coverage, were saying, well, actually, we think, because you're by definition conservative people, if you're going to have that kind of fund structure, you're probably going to overfund it because you don't want it to run out of money. And therefore, maybe as a rational investor, I'd quite like access to a product that didn't have the benefit of the Safeguard fund, and therefore takes a sort of naked return, if you like, because over time that's probably the rational thing to do. So we had a call from some people saying, could we have a slightly higher risk product and could we have that product without Safeguard. So we launched a product called Zopa Plus to deal with those people. And then we had another situation, which was that we used to differentiate and offer choice in lending term. So we had markets which went to fund 3-year loans, and we had a market that went to fund 5-year loans. And I think there's some confusion in that. Is that like buying a 3-year bond or a 5-year bond? Do you buy something that stops after 3 years and after 5 years? And the reality is it wasn't, because 90-something percent of our customers roll over their lending month on month. So whether you're actually buying 3-year loans or buying 5-year loans, you're sort of lending forever until you decide to stop. And therefore, titling them with a lending term, I think, was probably not particularly helpful. And therefore, you were really asking consumers to make a much more sophisticated choice, which is, do I think in 5 years the yield curve, you know, a 5-year asset should look different to a 3-year asset? And actually, I don't think that's something that our ordinary consumers are terribly interested in or knowledgeable about. So we thought getting rid of that term would be a good thing and make it clear that if you're lending, you're lending until you stop lending. And therefore, we decided to offer a product which had a different version of how you stop. In one case, if you stop, you sell your loans back into the marketplace, but you can do so without any cost. So if you think it's more likely than not that you're going to be only lending for a year or two, or you're just trying us out, then you might want to buy the product where you can sell your loans back at no cost. However, if you are like many of our customers, and in fact the majority of our customers, think I'm going to be lending forever until I stop, then you should take what we call a classic product, which is the closest to what we used to offer before. It effectively was an amalgamation of our 3-year market and our 5-year market to a non-term specific market, but with the benefit of Safeguard and a cost if you wish to liquidate your position. Now, in both of those products, one we call Access with free selling of loans, and the one called Classic where you pay 1% to sell your loans, you have no guaranteed liquidity. So we can't call them instant access savings accounts, because at the end of the day, you're dependent upon the market functioning to be able to realise your investment. While there's a primary market going on and there are new lenders coming in, then you will be able to sell your loans. But in a situation where there were no new lenders coming in and everyone was trying to sell their loans, you wouldn't.
Excellent. Well, clearly you've read the details of what you're doing far more than I have. And that's much clearer than what I'd managed to pick up by just reading things on Twitter, which is my usual in-depth research that I do.
You know, a good place to start would be the website.
The website,
which,
yes.
I think will explain it probably better than I just have.
Yes, yes. I think I spend too much time sort of travelling around, so I end up sort of reading things on the phone. There's a limit to how long an article you can read on the phone compared to being back on the computer. Well, that's very helpful, Giles. I mean, it's been sort of useful kicking around some of these kind of things. You know, I didn't want to have this conversation and reach a whole bunch of conclusions and say it's X, Y, Z, but I think that there's a whole bunch of parameters out there where people can be looking into. You know, we haven't touched on the sort of app-only banks that are coming along and trying to work their way through what they could possibly do. You know, there's always new species growing. If we forget this 1.0, 2.0, just think of an ecosystem. You know, there's new plants start growing over there.
I think it's encouraging that there are some quite different views emerging around what a challenge bank should look like, and that's good. I mean, I'm not sure I want to predict which ones will be the most successful, but I think it's good to see a divergence of views.
Well, just finishing on the challenger banks, I mean, my guest next week has spoken of the fact that people complain that challenger banks are too similar to the existing banks.
Some are.
And that's because the regulator insists on them having very similar people. And actually, I was just reading on my phone, coming in this morning, an interview with Tom Blumenfeld, Mondo, I think they've now changed their name. And there's a lot of pressure from the regulator saying, well, you're not a bank CEO, are you? And he's kind of saying, well, yes, but that's the point. And they're saying, well, no, actually, we quite like to see da-da-da-da-da. So these debates, these conversations between new fintechs trying to stretch the existing regulations, and Europe, various parties in the UK are going to continue. And there's an old saying, which is completely wrong, actually, which is that the Chinese character for change is the combination of two characters for threat and opportunity. It's not, but actually it should be, because all change contains threat and all change contains opportunity. So thank you for that, Giles, and I wish you every success with Zopa. You're still looking very much like a tree, which is slow, solid growth, although you've had some fertilizer put on recently, and it remains to be seen how strong the winds are going to blow in the 2018 crisis or whatever we've got ahead of us, or whether indeed it means that everybody grows faster. So thank you.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight dance.